Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
This is a true story. I couldn't possibly have made this up, it seems to me. But I was driving here last week, and I didn't pop this in last week because it happened on the drive. And somebody came up behind me, and they were really impatient. They were really in a big hurry. And on Henderson, and there was a little bit enough traffic that they were like, get out of the way. And I was driving the legal limit, but they were, you know, they needed to go faster than that. So when there was a safe occasion to do so, I kind of did what I could, and they went past me, and of course immediately came to a red light and stopped in front of me. And I pulled up behind them, and on their back window, and this is, yes, I broke the law. It's now on the podcast. I used my phone to take a picture.
It's the sticker that was on the, can you read that?
Right. Okay. So for those of you that are listening on the podcast, perhaps, or, you know, not in the room, the sticker on the back of this car that roared past me said, are you following Jesus this closely? And right. So there's both the sort of the, if you will, the, I don't want to overcook this, but sort of the moral irony, if I was feeling like I had the moral high ground somehow in traffic here, of just, you know, kind of religious bumper sticker being on this car that had just driven past me in a way that I would regard as, you know, rude, perhaps. But also, as I was sitting at this light reading this, are you following Jesus this closely sticker, I realized that how I read that sticker changed entirely depending on my internal tone. Is this a joke?
Yeah.
So right? Or is this somebody being self-righteous? Or, like, it totally changes the tone of the content. The textual content stays the same. How I thought about the content on the sticker changed the way I thought about the person at the wheel. And that was kind of the process that was going on for me for the rest of the drive.
The actions of the person behind the wheel change the interpretation of the sticker.
It's exactly, yes. And this is one of the things about belief and action that's really kind of intriguing, right? And in terms of the research, relatively young, in terms of the influence of belief on action, we've got lots of research about how our beliefs influence our actions, or how things we experience influence our beliefs. So we've talked about that, and we talk about changing our beliefs, right? We can have an experience where we're like, oh, that experience really doesn't square with the belief I held. But I had that experience, and I can't deny it, so now I have to address myself to the belief. But the research flowing the other direction is relatively young. How a belief that I hold can change how I experience an action and can even permission me to not experience something that's happening to me, right? So this is, I mean, now we're rapidly get into the land of trauma on this, but just being taught that I shouldn't have a certain feeling and then having that feeling, because my emotions aren't going to ask for permission from my beliefs, they're biochemical at the root and they're going to happen, can be an incredibly dissonant experience and can really challenge me to consider what I believe, and oftentimes to consider what I believe unconsciously, which is a pretty important and pretty fascinating part of any conversation about belief and belief change. Because so much of what we believe, we don't know we believe. We haven't brought it up to the front office and had a conversation with it. It's just perking away in the background. And lots of times, we don't know we believe certain things until something challenges that belief. Either consciously, like we choose to challenge it, or somebody external to us challenges it. We This is not an uncommon story, for example, for kids who grew up in really conservative, culturally conservative or ideologically conservative settings that were fairly insular and fairly thorough, where home believed the same thing the church believed, and home and church together comprised the majority of community and relationship. And then they go off to university. And people like Tim disabuse them of their cherished beliefs. Anybody who's kind of zoomed out a little bit says there's other ways to think about this. Or somebody travels to another country or culture for the first time and engages with that country or culture and goes, oh, wait a minute. There are good people who believe things that I was taught only bad people believe. There are beautiful people who believe things that I was taught were ugly beliefs, and so on, right? So those kind of things. But then in those experiences, what happens is we sort of go, oh, I have a belief about that I didn't necessarily know that I had. It was just there. The terrain that we're in is about choosing to change what we believe.
So which church on Henderson did they pull into?
They pulled into the bar. No, I'm kidding. I didn't notice where they pulled off Henderson. I think it was just on a residential street. Yeah, I should have followed the moment, got out of the car. And,
No. I was curious to see which church they were racing.
Yes, speeding along. What's the most intriguing read on that for me is that it is meant to judge me for following too closely. So quick review here just to kind of catch us up, or for people that are just joining us on this little how to change your beliefs journey. So we've talked about factors that influence belief change, and we've touched on a bunch of these just in the last few minutes: new information and experiences, changing environments, social influence, emotional and values-based factors. And then we started into this last week, how to actually change your beliefs, and a bit of a process-oriented perspective on this for our purposes. And we talked about quite a bit about last week about identifying your beliefs and how identifying what we believe is stop one, and it's a biggie, that it takes a lot of conscious effort lots of times to actually identify what we believe and to give language to what we believe. That's a not insignificant part of it, giving language to it. Language is what we have to work with when it comes to trading ideas with other people, but language is also, in many ways, what we have to work with when it comes to giving conscious shape to ideas that we hold for ourselves. What will I call this, and why will I call it that, essentially, about my beliefs? And am I calling what I believe by a certain name or giving it a certain kind of language or shape because that's what I was taught that it should be called? Have I ever examined that at all for myself? And one of the sort of main features of the landscape last week was Simone Weil's idea that really paying attention is actually the path to what she calls eternal wisdom. It's an interesting idea. And inside of that process, we talked about this notion of noticing what we're thinking. What in the realm of the life of the mind we would call automatic thoughts. The things that just pop into our head. When this person passed me, for example, I immediately had an opinion about them as a person. I know nothing about them as a person. I know nothing about their circumstance. To use one of my friends' illustrations of this, I don't know a thing about what the weather is like as they experience it. That's all imagined. That's all narrative for me, not fact. So that's a really important perspective when it comes to noticing what I think about what I believe. Because there are lots of voices inside of all of us that are not ours. Like they travel with us, but we inherited them. We didn't make them. And lots of them have things to say about what we believe. And a lot of those voices are what the things we experience as automatic or sort of unconsciously summoned thoughts. And the purpose of noticing those thoughts, among other things, and we talked about the importance of diarizing that experience, of actually making notes about this stuff, as a way to externalize it. The reason we're doing that in a process like this is so that we can start to see patterns in what we believe. So we can start to give voice to, give language to the automatic thoughts that just pop into our head. By way of sort of illustrating how this can work, imagine that you're somebody who really doesn't like to be late for things. It's a big value for you. Most of us, if we have a value like that, I think it's fair to say we've probably never asked ourselves why we have that value. We just know we don't like to be late. We like to be on time. It's important to us. Full stop. What a lovely value.
But then something happens that makes you late.
And all of a sudden, right, the way you're feeling has some heft to it. And it's more heft than just, I like to be early and not late, and now I'm late and I don't like that. Full stop. There's more going on in there. So that's where we start to get into asking questions about our automatic thoughts. So if we chase this down a little bit, I don't like this exercise, but it works. It's an exercise that I sometimes use for myself and that I share with other people. It's called the five whys. It's like living with somebody that's a parent that's closer to having young kids. What's the age where kids always do that why thing? It's like starts when like 2, 3-ish, right? Kind of in there. You tell a kid something and they're like, yeah, but why? And you answer their why question and then they're just like, yeah, but why? And they just, until you want to throw them out of the window. Metaphor. It gets annoying pretty fast. When we do it for or with ourselves, it's a bit annoying as well, but potentially pretty interesting. So to stay in this example of I'm somebody who doesn't like to be late, if I'm going to try to get to the core beliefs that are perking away underneath that, layer one is just why does it bother me to be late? Well, because I like to be on time. Why do I like to be on time? What matters about that? Well, if I'm on time meeting with other people, it's a way of honoring their time. Okay. Why does their time matter? And what does my behavior have to do with the value of their time? Doesn't their time have value whether I'm on time or not? Why does that work that way? And so we can just kind of keep working our way down. It wouldn't be bizarre in a story like that to discover that the reason that we want to be on time is because we want to be perceived a certain way. Right? We have a value about ourselves and our identity that's pinned to being on time. We might even believe that we wouldn't be a likable person if we weren't on time. Right? That wouldn't be a strange place to arrive when we played the five whys game with ourselves about the core value of I like to be on time. I like to be liked. But now we're talking about something quite different than just I like to be on time. Now we're talking about something that's core to our identity, core to our sense of who we are. I believe that I must be perfect, and being perfect includes being on time, and if I'm not perfect, I'm not likable. Wow. Good luck measuring that mark, right? Good luck liking yourself, if that's the core value. So now we have something really quite substantial to work with just by asking ourselves a few layers of questions about why we prefer to be on time, which seems like a fairly benign thing, right? We start to do an exercise like that with any core belief, we're going to peel the onion. We're going to start getting underneath whatever the core value is or belief that we have. Partly because of the series that we're in, and partly just because this is by personality, by experience, by inclination, all those things, this is sort of how I navigate the world, and I'm not uncomfortable with it. In fact, I kind of like questioning beliefs. But as I've been working on this series, I've been reminded in a number of ways of how disconcerting this can be, how disruptive it can be to examine what we believe. It can really feel like it shakes the foundations of who we are and how we identify ourselves. And it can really have a considerable impact on how we navigate the world. I've had occasion over the years to have lots of conversations with people whose beliefs are changing, have changed. I've sometimes joked with our kids in particular in a really vain attempt to describe what I do to other people. You just tell them your dad helps people lose their religion, which is not really true. I think there's certain aspects of exploring what you believe that can assail the organized part of religion. But also, we can be religious about anything. We can be religious about the notion that there is no deity. Right? It's deeply held belief, and as soon as we organize it for ourselves or together with others, we potentially have a thing we could use a word like religion for. So it's more about changing beliefs. But I've also realized in the midst of many of those conversations that consciously changing your beliefs can seriously rock your world. Our beliefs provide a frame for action. And when we change them, sometimes we're not sure how to act. On the other side of that, we don't know what it looks like to be ourselves in the world when we are fiddling with core beliefs. It can be incredibly disruptive. So for me, that brings this process to a next, what I would say is a fairly logical, rational kind of point, which is only one way to look at this, right? There's lots of things about core belief and examining them and reconsidering them that doesn't fall readily to the rational. It's really about a realm that reaches beyond that into mystery and in the realm of spirit. But I'm going to stay pretty in our heads on this one. And I would say that if we're kind of working our way through this process where we're questioning the thoughts that automatically pop into our head, we're kind of 5-Y-ing them, if you will, or however we want to do that, we're making some notes about what thoughts we automatically have that we realize are guiding us, what we haven't been conscious of them. So we start to name them. We start to see patterns in that process, and we start to say, oh, there's a pattern of belief there that is not healthy or that is unexamined. Might not even be unhealthy. It might just be unconscious, and it's becoming conscious, and I want to examine it. I would say that a good next step in a process like that is actually considering the evidence for our belief. What is it that underpins it? We might discover, it wouldn't be unusual to discover, that we hold some beliefs for which there is either no evidence or no good evidence, or we just haven't thought about whether there's any evidence for them. They were handed to us. We were formed in and around them. That's the way we hold them. We've never examined them. And sometimes the reason we haven't examined them is really good. Like sometimes we hold unexamined beliefs because we deeply trust the people who handed them to us. How lovely is that? To be formed in an environment where there's trust, right? And they were handed to us in many cases, I hope maybe for all of us, they were handed to us by people who loved us, who still love us. There was love in there. There was care in there. There was nurturance in there. There was safety in there. When I get handed a core belief by somebody with whom I have that sort of relationship, when I start to examine that core belief, I'm re-examining that relationship. It doesn't mean I'm feeling negatively about it. It means I'm thinking critically about it. And that's a different layer of a relationship. It's a different layer of a relationship personally. It's a different layer of relationship more broadly. So systemically, it's a different layer. And organizationally, it's a different layer. So a different relationship with my father who taught me belief X. I would be more personal about this. In this case, the example that comes to my mind from my story is my relationship with my mom, which was and remained a good, substantive, loving one to the end of her life, right? It was a good relationship all the way through. My mom taught me many things that I value that guide my life consciously. She also taught me some beliefs that are full-on, unequivocally racist. She was a person of her time. Is that an excuse? No, it is an explanation, but it is not an excuse. And later in her life, when some of those beliefs were challenged, I had actual conversations where I could kind of watch her working it through and going, oh, I see what you're saying. But I already had the belief, and I had to do the work of, and continue to have to do the work of, reconsidering those beliefs and rethinking them and putting them in a different frame in my life and how I operate and how they change my automatic thoughts. In this case, to be really concrete, I don't want you to be brutal about this, and yet I also think this is probably familiar terrain for some of us. I grew up in a small northern town, high percentage-wise, high indigenous population. Many of that population were as is often the case with indigenous people or with anyone, were people who'd grown up with a great deal of trauma in their lives. And one of the results of that trauma was that they had trouble navigating the everyday world and also systemic violence and systemic deprivation and oppression. And so there were lots of these folks who, in this little town of 2,000 people, were visibly unhoused and struggling. Well, isn't it lovely to have a narrative for that? It really is very comforting if we can say, the reason those people don't have somewhere to live is because they're lazy. If they just get a job, they could afford an apartment, and they'd be fine. That's a very tidy narrative for the fact that that person is on the street and clearly struggling, isn't it? It's a completely inadequate narrative, but it sure sews it up and puts a bow on it. What's the evidence for that, for me, in that narrative that I learned growing up? Well, the evidence is, that's how my mom taught me the world works around this issue. That's all the evidence. And it kind of goes click. It's easy, right? I can put that one to bed. It's not my problem. It's their problem. It's a character problem. It's a racial problem. But it's not my problem in that narrative. So when I go back to re-examine that, and that's an unconscious thought, driving down the street, see somebody in that circumstance, got a story for that. Done. No more effort required. If I go in to start working with that and I start considering the evidence for that belief, I don't have to travel more than a few pages into a consideration of that from somebody else's perspective to realize, oh, not only is there evidence around this issue, but it's nothing like my narrative. And now I have a really serious piece of work to do. Right? So when we start to consider the evidence for what we believe, almost inevitably, at some point, we encounter some version of that experience. We realize we hold an unexamined or unfounded or a belief that if it has some evidence around it, that evidence only stands up when you look at it from a particular perspective. And as soon as you change your perspective, it weakens the evidence. I mean, I was doing graduate level Christian theology when I sort of stepped away from formal education and all of that. Lots of evidence for my beliefs being offered to me by trustworthy, deeply intelligent, thoughtful people whom I think of that way to this day. What I've realized since is that that evidence, much of it, only coheres within that system. And it's really quite a well-developed system over the last couple of thousand years. It's pretty thorough. I can live with those answers, perhaps, if I choose to stay inside that system. But as soon as I go outside of it and I look at that same evidence, I realize, I start asking it the five whys questions, I realize it's standing on presuppositions that I may not share. Let's just pick a big obvious one. It's all standing, generally speaking, all's too thorough, it's generally standing on the presupposition that there's a God. Well, that's an idea. It's a really big, important one, and it's got all sorts of things that point to it as a reasonable one, but also it goes considerably beyond the reason part of it. It's an idea. So if my unconscious framework as a starting point is there is a God and it's a personified deity, it's a being, then that whole system works pretty good. Take one step away from that presupposition, which is foundational, and a whole bunch of things start to be very, very shaky very, very fast. So that's the way, whether we go down that path or not is not my point. My point is, as soon as we start to do this kind of work, if we do it with some authenticity, some integrity, we're going to have the sorts of experiences that shake things up pretty good. I should just close the loop a little bit on that particular idea, because it's maybe especially disconcerting for some folks. Every faith formation model that I'm aware of, and I'm certainly not aware of all of them, but I've studied several of them, and I would say probably most of the main ones, has some kind of a curve to it, where somewhere in that process of forming our beliefs, we start to question them, and that starts to make things kind of shaky, and we start to feel like whatever we call our beliefs, or our core beliefs, or our faith, or system of belief, whatever language we're using, kind of comes to a low point, kind of bottoms out, where we're like, I don't even know if I believe anything anymore. I had one of these conversations in the middle of this week with somebody again, where they're just like, I'm having an existential crisis. Because what I used to believe, I don't believe anymore. I don't know what I might believe in the future. I don't feel like I believe anything right now. And I was, and it got pretty concrete. This person was like, if I got cancer, I'm not sure why I'd get treated. Because I'm not sure I want to be here in this state of being. Right? Fair. That's the bottom of the curve. Where the models tend to take us is that we start to build something coming out of that bottom of the curve. We start to build something that is more ours, more consciously ours, that we can live with. With some joy. And it takes us to, and this is my favorite language for this out of all the models that I studied, it takes us to a place that the particular model I'm thinking of calls conscious naive, which is a place where we believe something and we know we can't defend it evidentiarily. We can't prove it. And we know it, and we can articulate that. We say, I have this belief. I know it might even sound crazy to you. I can't defend it. It's not necessarily entirely rational, But it is mine, and it guides me in these ways. I can tell you how this ripples out in my life. When we start to hold beliefs that way, one of the things that is more often than not true about those beliefs is they are up for grabs, and we know it. And that means we hold them differently. And I would argue that categorically, chosen naive as a frame for belief or faith makes us much less likely to weaponize our beliefs. Because they're not concrete. They're real to us, but we know they're real to us. And they're not necessarily real to everyone else, and nor should they be everyone else's. And that means we navigate the world differently with them. It doesn't mean we care about them less or believe them less, but it means we're not likely to beat somebody else over the head with the fact that they ought to believe, they need to believe what we believe. Now, there's another big set of core beliefs that percolates around and in all of what I just said that we're not going to get into this morning, but that's the belief that humans need to be saved. That's also a narrative, right? So you stand back from that one step and you realize, well, if I didn't believe that we are all headed for eternal damnation unless something else happens, that changes the way I frame any number of beliefs, including why I would behave certain ways morally. Why would I be good in the world if there's no eternal consequence to it? Is it even worth it? Or should I just be a selfish so-and-so and get what's mine and whatever I get it and whatever it costs somebody else? That's not my problem because there's no downside. I'm going for it. We can see that behavior, right? We can see what that looks like. We might not want to behave that way. But do we need a narrative of I'm going to burn forever if I misbehave to underpin that? Or is there plenty of evidence about why that's a good choice without that narrative? Those are interesting questions. So when we get into the train of examining or considering the evidence for our beliefs, I'm not gonna blow sunshine at anybody here. The water's deep, right? So we might not want to go there. And I don't say that as a judgment. That's just a fact. We're not all wired, inclined at the point of required to do this. This is also a choice. When we've got some of that in hand, the next step in this tidy little process here is to challenge what we believe. So challenging what we believe, I've sort of touched on this already, but to kind of put it into a tidier form, challenging my beliefs is actively questioning the validity of my beliefs and consciously considering the evidence for what I believe and also consciously considering the evidence against what I believe. My mom would have called this looking for trouble. She wouldn't necessarily be wrong about that, right? When I go consciously digging around in the evidence against what I believe, it's pretty important work. Because if what I believe can't stand up to legitimate evidence, and I need to have some conscious process for what constitutes evidence in this whole structure, but if they won't stand up to challenging evidence, then I should have some serious questions about the nature of that belief. Not should I have it, necessarily. That's one of the questions. But another really important question is, what kind of belief is this? Like, if this belief doesn't stand up to the evidence that challenges it, how should I hold this belief? Do I really want to wrap my life around this? Or is this kind of one of those, I think I kind of believe this, my behavior tends to suggest I believe this, and also, there are some reasons why that might not cohere under certain circumstances, and I know that. So I'm going to navigate that belief and its implications for my behavior differently if I think about that belief that way, right? And we can hold, I would say that if we wanted to think about this like a layer cake, I can hold beliefs differently on different layers. And some of us have never considered that idea either because we were taught beliefs are binaries. Either you have the right belief or you have the wrong belief, and that's the whole story about belief. But functionally, we all know that's not true. We all know that we do not behave that way. Back to my bumper sticker, following Jesus closely story, right? I believe I should keep the law. I should drive by the speed limit. Except when the person next to me in the passenger seat is bleeding to death. Or pick a circumstance, right? So we can call that whatever we want. There's lots of different moral language around that. Situational ethics is sort of a, you know, one that would have loomed large in my education, for example. But we can hold different beliefs differently. I believe that taking this dose of this vitamin is going to correct this symptom that I'm experiencing in 4 months. I take that vitamin for 4 months and the symptom doesn't change. I have to, among other things, address myself to that belief. Because now I have a question. Do I keep going with this path? With this modality of addressing that symptom? Or do I have to wonder if maybe my belief was wrong and I should try something different? Right? So we can do this with lots of beliefs. That's a fairly, maybe a fairly sort of trivial example, depending on the symptom, maybe not, right? But all we're doing is examining a belief and reconsidering it when we do that. So challenge our beliefs. Look for the evidence for and against them. And this is really pragmatic. I once had a friend accuse me of being a pragmatic idealist. That was more than that was 20 years ago. And it stuck with me as a piece of self-identity. I'm like, yep. I don't mind living in that space. I want to have North Stars. I want to have ideals that are over the horizon that I know I can't possibly live up to. And also, I got some problems to solve today. I need to be practical about that. And so this is part of that evidentiary process, right? And when we move out of the evidence into challenging our beliefs, one of the questions that we're asking ourselves is there a more useful, is there a more accurate, is there a more meaningful, ultimately, is there a more believable way for me to deal with whatever this belief addresses? It's worth remembering, I think, that every belief is formed in context. We make beliefs out of things. We assemble them as humans. It's what we do. Heard Bill Bryson, familiar name to anybody? Bryson wrote famously Short History of Almost Everything, or Nearly Everything, I think was the title of the original book, 20, 25 years ago, just updated it. Bryson likes to talk about, and he addresses himself to the history of science in this book as well. It was a popular book, and he's quick to say he doesn't know anything about science, more than any high schooler, right? But brilliant book in the terms that it gives us these basics. And he says one of the things that not all scientists like, and this is one of the reasons we had so much problem around science in the pandemic, is because not all scientists are quick to say, this is all work in progress. None of this is meant to be the last word on something. It's meant to be the word we have now. And we're testing it. And that's our job. And so if we take that kind of perspective on our beliefs, and I'm going to test this, is there a more useful, accurate, meaningful, or believable way to think about this subject or about this belief? There's nothing wrong with saying, this belief in this shape is more believable to me than this belief in that shape. That's not a bad process, especially if we take the whole process and we sort of flip it around, so we now acknowledge as part of holding a belief that our belief really might change. That if we went back in our little outline here to all those things that can impact us and change our beliefs, we would have to acknowledge some of those are liable to happen to us. That's the way life goes. We're liable to have experiences that really challenge our beliefs. If we have permission to change our beliefs, those experiences become potentially less disruptive as regards our core beliefs. Because now we're like, I might not have seen the particularity of that coming, but I should have seen categorically that coming. Because that's how life goes. Things happen to and around us that will challenge our beliefs. Period. How are we going to handle that? What does it look like to be a person with healthy beliefs, given that that's the way life behaves? That's the way it operates. Now, one way to respond to all of that, of course, is to simply say, I don't care what happens. This is what I believe. And if I'm going to be a true believer, I need to not change what I believe. That's what it means to have strong faith. It doesn't matter what challenges come along. But now what I have is a belief that I have to have denial to hold. And I think there's a reasonable argument to be made there that that's not a very healthy way to live as regards our beliefs either. Peace, everybody.